bringing the Mining Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Let's see here. Glenn, you had a chance to look at the minutes. Move the minutes from the last meeting? Oh, no, you weren't here, so we can't have you move the minutes. Representative Lewick moves the minutes from the last meeting. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Okay, folks. Representative Russo, you have a guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to introduce a student, Sarah Bean. If you want to stand up, Sarah. Sarah's been shadowing me today to find out about our work down here at the legislature. So if we can welcome Sarah. Thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Folks, I have a constituent of my own that's been shadowing me today, and I'd like to introduce him. Brent Lee is I graduated from high school with Brent many years ago, 1970, and he's a retired DNR employee. He worked for the DNR for many, many years out of Carlos Avery, and please welcome Brent to our committee. Thanks for stopping down and visiting with us today. So with that, I will move House File 2843, and we're going to move this bill to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. With us today, we have Mr. Don Pereira with the DNR, and you want to present our bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Don Pereira, representing Minnesota DNR, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to come and present what is a very, very important piece of legislation for the section of fisheries. This addresses one of the longest standing and most serious problems we have in the state for sport fishing, and that is properly trying to manage northern pike. We've done a lot of technical work over the past year and an awful lot of outreach with our stakeholders as well, and you'll probably hear from some of them later during this testimony. So with that, I want to introduce our area manager, Gary Barnard, who was the key driver on our technical committee. He has a brief presentation that will lay out a lot of technical details for this bill.
Very good. And you are the fisheries chief at the Minnesota DNR?
That's correct.
Correct. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gary Barnard. I'm the area fisheries supervisor from Bemidji, and I've been working on the Northern Pike Technical Committee for a number of years.
Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you.
We'll get started. This is your PowerPoint that we have in our packet, members.
Yes.
Yes. So if it responds, we'll get going.
We're having some technical difficulties earlier, and they might be continuing.
Yeah, apparently.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, we could walk through.
We'll just have to walk through the PowerPoint without.
Again, it's the same as we provided your committee.
Okay. So. Were there copies in the back of this
PowerPoint? There are. We provided 25
okay.
copies for the audience.
Excellent.
As well.
Very good. Please proceed.
Okay, we'll go through it the paper way. First slide there would be some background of really where the problem started. And if you look at this is taken from records of large pike that were entered in a fuller tackle contest around the Park Rapids area over time. And if you look right about the late 40s or right after World War II, you can start to see that decline. It's a pretty steady decline in pike size. So number three here, the good old days pike fishing kind of behind us there. And some of those catches like you see in that photo are kind of a thing of the past. The current state is more like what you see on the next slide there, with lots of small pike and pretty hard to find those larger pike in some of these lakes in northern Minnesota. But this problem isn't just the loss of big pike. What's happened when we've lost big pike is we're seeing an increase in pike abundance, and that's shown in... back online?
I think the computer's too slow.
Okay. What you see in that graph is from our surveys across the north central part of the state, it's the number of pike caught per gill net lift over time, and you can see that where it used to be down around 4 per gill net lift, it's up there exceeding 7 per net lift now, which is pretty high. So what is the real biological problem here with this? And I'll tick through this for you. So decades of selective removal of those large pike. Once the large pike are gone, the selectivity just goes down to smaller and smaller pike, and finally the medium-sized pike are gone from the population. And these pike populations respond with increased production of young pike, and what they're trying to do is fill that void that's been created when the large pike are gone. This results in very high densities of small pike in these lakes, and the competition slows their growth then, so they stay small longer, and it really compounds the problem. And furthermore, it results in a decline in their forage base because they're all competing for the likes of perch and shiners and that kind of thing. And it's reducing our effectiveness of walleye stocking in some of these lakes, both through predation from these pike and through competition, direct competition with our stocked walleye. And there's a ripple effect on the rest of the fish community. It can even cause a slower growth in panfish. So what we're proposing, when we looked at this thing across the entire state, it became obvious that the small pike problem isn't a statewide issue. And that this is, if you look at the map here, that green zone there, the north central zone, is really where we have the worst problem with the small pike, the loss of large pike. Real high pike recruitment in that zone. That's a production of young pike. But if you move up to the northeast, and that's kind of that pink shaded area there, those populations are still in pretty good shape. They have good natural reproduction, but it's not excessive, and they don't have the fishing pressure to have knocked down the big pike at this point, so they're still functioning pretty well up in the northeast. The southern zone, though, is almost the direct opposite of that north central, where they don't have very good reproduction at all down there. They've cropped off the big pike, but you're not getting that same recruitment response of a lot of small pike. In fact, we stock a lot of the lakes in southern Minnesota just to create pike fisheries down there. So a whole different scenario in the southern part of the zone, or southern part of the state. So you can see why one regulation probably doesn't fit all three of these zones, wouldn't be effective in all three. So what we're proposing is three different zones for management of pike. And then if you look at the next slide there, the next page, these are the key population objectives for the zones. And that north central, and really that's the key behind this initiative, it's to reduce small pike abundance. And to do that, we want to increase the abundance of medium to large pike again and get back some of that suppression effect that those pike had on young pike in these populations. In the northeast, where those populations are still in pretty good shape, the objective there is to protect large pike where we still have them, because it's always a lot easier to protect what you have than to restore it once it's gone. So that's the objective up there. And then in the south, it's kind of the reverse. There we want to protect small pike. We have really fast-growing populations down there. These pike grow really quickly, so we want to increase pike abundance there and capitalize on that exceptional growth just to grow some larger pike in those populations. Well, if you flip to the next page, the frying pan page, this is an objective that really overshadows all three of the others, to maintain or improve harvest opportunity. That's what we want to do in all three of those zones. So that becomes more of a fishery objective than a population objective. This is for the anglers. And we've heard loud and clear over the years when we've talked about pike regs that northern pike are a food fish. They're made to be harvested and eaten. So if we don't have that objective in these regulations for these zones, we're probably not going to be effective here. So we understand the need to maintain harvest opportunity. So next page is the proposed angling regulations that we're suggesting for the three zones. In the north central, we've got a proposing a 10 fish daily bag limit, and that's for small pike under 22 inches. And this provides a lot of extra harvest opportunity for these small pike that are in surplus anyway. So why not let anglers have them, and they can participate in reducing pike abundance. But the real key there is the 22 to 26 inch protected slot. And that's the part of this regulation that's actually going to grow larger fish and provide some of the suppression effect back on those small fish in the population. And these numbers, the 22 lower end of this protected slot was picked for a reason. It's not just an arbitrary number, but this is kind of the tipping point when anglers really start to harvest more of the pike than they release. So that's when those fish need protection. And we're looking at a pretty narrow slot here, a 4-inch slot, but it will protect about 64% of the fish medium to large in the population. So it's really getting the best bang for the buck for a very narrow range there in the protected slot. And then the 2 over 26, that gets back to the harvest component of this, that people still want to be able to catch decent-sized pike and have a shore lunch or whatever and have a nice meal of pike at the end of the day. So the slot is designed for fish to actually grow through it and actually grow back to the harvest fishery again, and that's very important. And with the upper end at 26 inches, even the males can get big enough to grow out of there, so they're not protected for life in that slot. Moving to the northeast zone, again, what we have up there is, you know, we do still have large fish in the population, and the objective there was to protect the large fish while they still exist. And we first proposed a 30-inch maximum size limit where you couldn't harvest any pike over 30. And through the public review process, we got a lot of comments on that regulation. People do want that ability to harvest a real trophy pike if they catch one, say, over 40 inches. So after taking the public input and hearing from a lot of anglers and groups, we went to a 30 to 40-inch protected slot there. Biologically, it still protects the large fish in the population to the greatest extent. There's the rare fish that does get over 40 inches, you know, can be a trophy opportunity. And a 2-fish daily bag limit there provides a lot of harvest opportunity because really most of the pike population is under 30 inches, so most of that will be available to harvest for shore lunches and the like. Then in the southern zone, we've proposed a little different thing here, is a 24-inch minimum size limit. And that basically protects those young fish, keeps them in the population a little bit longer. And it's really not a lot longer because they're growing very quickly down there. So 2 or 3 years, they're going to be growing out of that slot and be available to, or out of that protected size range and be available to anglers and spears again. And a 2-fish bag limit down there, it's more restrictive than the old 3-fish limit. But really, your opportunity to get larger fish will kind of counteract that. So we expect about the same yield in pounds of fish harvested over 24 than what you would get with a mix of fish under 24. So those are the proposed regulations. Don mentioned that we've done a lot of outreach on this. I've done this pike presentation to numerous roundtable presentations. Our technical committee has been involved in this. We've worked closely with a lot of groups. Two roundtables, the 2015 and 2016 roundtable, previous Senate subcommittee. We held 11 public meetings statewide on this, and we got some attendance there. Not a lot of attendance, but we also put it up on our DNR website, and we received a lot more comments to the DNR website than actual attendance at the meetings. And I think attendance at public meetings can tell us a couple of things. We know that when you get a lot of attendance at a public meeting, there tends to be some opposition. And we find that when there's not a lot of opposition, we don't get big turnouts. So having light attendance at those meetings might have meant a lot of people are okay with this. And what we were hearing in comments, well, switch over to the next page, I guess. The public comments on the website, we had about 600 comments there. A lot of support for what we're trying to do. People really recognize this problem statewide and have been actually pushing for us to do something about it for quite some time. So they want to see this tackled. We would get comments about tweaking the edges of the slot an inch or two either way, but general good support for actually doing something to address this pike issue. The next slide or sheet here is deals with dark house spearing, and that was one of the things that came up quite a bit in public comments. How would this affect dark house spearing? So we know that we need length-based regulations for angling, but they're not very compatible with spearing. And that's been pushed back on special regulations that we've had and experimental regulations over the years. So we finally realized that we probably just need to manage these two methods of harvest differently, because we do that with archery, muzzle loaders, and rifles. It's just a different manner of take, so maybe it needs to be managed with different regulations. We don't want to see dark house spearing come to an end because we're putting a broad regulation across a whole range. It might have been appropriate with a few experimental lakes where they could go to different lakes, but in this case, they're going to have to fish the same lake, so they may need a different set of regulations to make it compatible. Another part of the public input that we took that I didn't mention before was we actually contracted with the University of Minnesota social scientists there to do a survey of just licensed buyers, both spearing license and angling licenses. And this way you get a broader look at just what the average angler, the average spearer is thinking on these things, because they don't always attend public meetings and they don't always come to our work groups and things like that. So we looked at that, and a couple of graphs that you'll see here. Acceptability of zone regulations. This is just managing by different zones, and people were pretty acceptable of that concept, and again, recognizing that there's differences across the state. The different colors on that chart are broken down by anglers, just general anglers, not necessarily targeting pike, but just anglers in general. And then those that said they did actually target northern pike, and then spearers, which obviously target northern pike. So you can see the amount. This is the percent who find these regulations unacceptable, and there's always some level of that. You'll see the first bar graphs there are actually people who find the statewide regulation unacceptable now, and that compares pretty favorably with the rest of them. But the next two sets there, it's looking at that northeast regulation, and you can see the 30-inch maximum got a lot more of an unacceptable rating than the 30 to 40 inch, so that kind of drove that decision. And then the other two are the 22 to 26 protected slot and the two fish bag limit in southern Minnesota. People really, really kind of like that one. It's minimum size limits and a two fish bag is pretty easy to understand there. That one compares real favorably with the current statewide daily bag limit. And then one other one that we pulled out of the report here from the U of M was just acceptability of having alternate regulations for spearers. And, this is kind of a new concept that we haven't done in the past, so we're wondering how much acceptance there'd be for that. And, again, this is the percent who find these alternatives unacceptable. And it's a fairly low percentage, down in the 20 to 25% for a number of scenarios here where pike anglers would have one regulation and spears would have a different regulation. So if you move to the table, that's called the current proposal. This lays out where we're at currently. I went through the angling regulation part of that already, and the red underlines are just things that have changed since our original proposal. So you can see the 30 to 40 inch protected slot there now replaces the 30 inch maximum in the northeast. And then a different set of spearing regulations, which are actually pretty similar to the angling regulations. We've got the 10 fish bag limit, that opportunity to take a lot of those small fish. But there's an exception here where they're allowed to have a fish within the slot limit, and that's understanding that difficulty of being able to recognize and judge size under the water. So you wouldn't be made a criminal by just making a mistake of spearing a fish within the slot for the. So they really have the option there of taking a fish within the slot and one over or the two over. And they've got some incentive, obviously, to spear the larger fish over the slot. But if they make a mistake, it's okay there. In the Northeast, we did something a little bit different. We removed the slot completely there and went with a one allowed over 26 for spears. So they really, for that first fish, don't have to worry about the size so much. Now this is, it's less restrictive than anglers for pike over 30 inches, but it's actually more restrictive between 26 and 30. So there's a little trade-off there, but it's a regulation that can work for spears as well. And in the South, again, those regulations are the same for spearing and angling, and that seemed to be acceptable to most, that they're really not looking for those small fish anyway. They're looking for larger fish above 24 inches, and they thought they could comply with that minimum length limit there, because the farther it gets from the protected range, the more desirable the fish in that situation down there. And that regulation, I think they did realize the benefits there as well in having larger pike to spear and angle in the southern zone if this regulation goes through. So we've looked ahead, we've prepared an evaluation plan here to be able to evaluate how well these regulations are working. So we did some lake selection, and just using pre-data, we've got an incredible database here of lake surveys. Over the last 20 years, where we've been keeping individual fish lengths and weights and that kind of thing back to 93. There's about 1,500 lakes in this data set, and that have had northern pike sampled in their assessments. And that covers 5,700 surveys and 275,000 measured pike. So that's an incredibly powerful data set to be able to analyze some change from. And for a post-regulation plan, then, to evaluate what changes with these regulations, first we need some time delay for the regulations to have some effect. So we're looking at a five-year delay so that the populations can actually change. And then we've done some power analysis to see how much sampling it would take after that point to actually see a change, depending on how much change occurs. So we're looking at, in years 6 to 10 out there, we statewide with 28 management areas, we get about 200 lake surveys a year. So by year 10, we'd accumulate another 1,000 lake surveys to be able to analyze data from that. So the ability to see whether this is working or not is going to be incredibly more efficient than looking at an individual lake and trying to see how a experimental regulation works. But there's some different expectations by zones here. Here's a couple of charts that follow here in the north central zone, and this again, it's once we waited at least 5 years for some change to occur, how quickly could we see the change if it does occur? And we're looking here, a 10% change, we'd be able to see that in 2 to 3 years if that occurs. And that's because there's so many surveys being done in that north central zone. Another example is the southern zone here, where it's going to take a little bit longer because there's fewer surveys. But for percent change, you can see if it's a 25% change, we'll be able to detect that a lot sooner than we would with a 10% change, and we're looking for some big changes down there, actually. So that's the proposal kind of in a nutshell for you.
Very good. Members, questions? Okay, very good. We'll take some public testimony then. Thank you for your presentation. Good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tim Spreck, Minnesota Dark Horse Association. After Tim, we'll take any other public testimony, people that haven't had a chance to say anything that might want to say a few words on this issue. But we're running behind schedule. We had some technical difficulties earlier. We've got a number of bills to get through, and they're pretty lengthy, so we're going to try to keep things short today, get some things done. Please introduce yourself for the record, your name, and who you represent for the record.
Good Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Spreck. I'm here representing the interests of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association. It's a pleasure to appear before this committee again. This is one of my favorite committees with some of my favorite people on it, so I look forward to it every time I can appear here. My comments today are going to be very short and sweet. The DNR has accommodated the Dark House Spearing constituency on this particular set of pike regulation proposals that we've worked with them for the better part of the last 2 years to make sure the interests of the spear fishermen have been taken care of. And as you all know, there's a difference in the method it takes, so we have to accommodate each group differently. So we appreciate the DNR's willingness to work with us on this. We are fine with the regulation proposals as they have been packaged up for you today. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions, members? Thank you. Anybody from the audience like to speak to this bill? Please come forward quickly. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of Anglers for Habitat. I have with me today Mr. Jim Lilienthal, who will speak on behalf of our group. I just want to thank the committee and the DNR for presenting this bill. They've done a lot of work. We've worked on this for over 2 years to vet this issue and bring it before the committee. One of the neat things we learned, by the way, is when you're cleaning northern pike, we've always filleted them. And, of course, anyone's ever done that has found that naughty little Y bone that sticks in there. But if we found out if you cut them like a sirloin or like a swordfish steak, cut them like that in a cube or whatever, you can cook that Y bone right out of there and save a lot of meat. So we just want to pass that on to all those folks. Try that next time you catch a northern and see how it works. I'd love to know. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name and who you represent.
My name is Jim Lilienthal. I'm with Anglers for Habitat and with a lot of other organizations. Previously, I was a area fisheries supervisor in the Little Falls area, and my whole career was spent in this north central zone where the most significant pike problems exist. And I made a presentation to the round table in 2014 where I looked at all the lakes that receive walleye stocking in the state, and from those I looked at the northern pike gill net catches that were in those particular lakes. And it was really quite shocking to me. I had seen a lot of it in my own area where I worked, but it wasn't until I retired that I actually found the time to be able to look at things statewide and see what this problem, how this problem was, how bad this problem was. And I found that in a zone which is virtually the same zone that the state found after the 2 years that they had re-studied this after that presentation to the round table. And I absolutely support what this proposal has. It covers everything. It has something for the people who want large fish. It covered the needs of the spearing community. It's a very collaborative thing. I'm also a member of the ESOX committee, Citizens Advisory Committee now. And on December 10th, we voted unanimously to approve this. That includes citizen members from the spearing community, the angling community, and Northern Pike Clubs, and others that, again, have been collaborating. We're also pleased that this conflict is behind us and hope that with this proposal we can look to something new. But when I did my study, if I can quickly get this in, I also, as I mentioned, was looking at walleye lakes and stocked walleye lakes. And there's over 1,000 lakes that are receiving walleye stocking in the state. And of those, 70% are in this north central zone. And what I found was that 372 of those 722 lakes that are stocked with walleye in the north central zone had high-density populations of these small northern pike that were, and so I looked further into the how these were impacting the results of stocking, walleye stocking, and I found that in one of the more primary places that I looked at in Otter Tail County, where the most walleye stocking lakes are located, 83, 38 of those, or 46%, had high-density populations of northern pike. What I found was that those lakes with the high-density pike populations had 50%, on average, 50% lower returns to angler of walleye than the lakes that did not receive that the lakes with normal northern pike populations, less than 4 per gillnet. What I used as my criteria was from research at, that was done by Don, I believe both Don Pereira and by Brad Parsons, that put a number of about 7 per gillnet as where the problem level begins. And I took that into more detail, but the bottom line is we have a heck of a problem out there with these small pike, and they are creating a real problem for walleye management in this state. And what I wanted to say is there is a consequence to not doing this, and that is by not correcting this, we stand the chance of not being able to improve the efficiency of our walleye stocking program by as much as 50%. And that's, as a former area fishery supervisor who's fed his fair share of walleye fingerlings, which are now up to about a dollar a piece, to northern pike, I'm, you know, this is one of the greatest opportunities to improve walleye fishing on the greatest number of lakes in the state, and it doesn't cost anything. How can we lose with this? So it's extremely, extremely important, not only for the walleye, or not only for the northern pike, but for walleye. They've decimated yellow perch populations, which is part of the reason why the walleye aren't surviving. And with the perch populations down, also on the lakes that don't receive walleye stocking, it's had a huge impact on the stunting of sunfish populations because the perch prey on the small sunfish, on the larval sunfish, and reduce their numbers so they have good growth. Okay, the big thing in here is we really, really want to see the support for this bill. It's earned it through collaboration, and I really want to thank all the members of the citizens groups and that have put their time in and made this the good bill that it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Anybody? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you very much. Thank you for your hard work on this bill. Anyone else in the audience like to speak to the bill? Well, with that, I will renew my motion to move this bill to where we're sending it. Government Operations and what else is it called? Government Operations and Election Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill has moved on. Thank you very much, members. Thank you for that. Representative McNamara moves House File 2866, and it has to go to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Housekeeping Minnesota DNR technical policy bill. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Amendment A1. It's mostly a technical amendment, but I'll have Commissioner Meyer maybe explain exactly what it does.
Well, we'll get the amendment put on. All in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think what I'll do is just turn it over to Commissioner Meyer. I think is my motion to send it to
civil law.
To civil law. You said that already, actually, didn't you? Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I move it?
You moved the bill.
I did. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Let me just describe the amendment really quickly. What we're doing here in Section 5 is our original language added aquatic plant, macroscopic non-woody aquatic plant, to the definition of aquatic macrophyte. We're trying to get the definition in line with the recently identified stony stornwort, AIS, new aquatic invasive species that was found in Lake Coronis. So the actual adding of the words macroalgae helps further clarify that, so that a person with a boat that may sit in a lake for the entire year, such as Lake of the Woods, wouldn't have to completely scrape off all of the plant material off of that boat, the scum and things like that. So we're just clarifying that it's a macroalgae that's there. As Representative McNamara said, this is a DNR policy technical bill. Mostly it's technical. So I will let you know where the technical pieces are, and then we'll talk about the little bit of policy that's in there. And I believe you will also have a House research summary before you. There's several sections of the bill as we start off changing listed to designated. We had a bill last year to do change designated to listed, and we got a few too many things changed in statute. So we're changing that back from listed to designated in Section 1, just the process we do use to do that. And also Section 2 under game and fish rules, we're changing, you'll see on 2.5, striking list, inserting designate, 2.6, clarifying that we listing infested waters. Section 3 of the bill also changes that list to the term designate under the permanent rule requirements of the DNR. Section 4 is a policy piece, a new policy piece for us, and what this language does, it will exempt tribal band members who possess a tribal identification card from the requirements of a state wild rice license. In our discussions with the band throughout the state in recognition of their cultural significance of wild rice, we thought that we could allow them not to have this license. It's a small fiscal impact. We sold $4,000 worth of licenses. So in an effort to improve our relationships with them, we thought we would do that. They do support that. Section 5, we talked about the stony stornwort language. Section 6 clarifies that a person can have dead, like if you have a beer can that has zebra mussels on it or something like that. Previously, it was against the law to own or to have that in your possession, any things that's containing invasive species. So this would clarify that if it's dead or like covered in plastic or something like that, you'd be able to have that in your possession. Section, so that you can see on the fact sheet here, removes an exemption from the ban on possessing prohibited invasive species for those who have acquired them dead. Section 7 clarifies a law related to non-native species, aquatic plants, and aquatic macrophytes, that it includes all parts of the organism rather than whether dead or alive. It's a clarification that we needed to provide in statute that we ran across in a court case. So I want to just clarify that it includes all parts of the organism there. Section 8 gets into what is one of the bigger parts of the bill, which will allow us to, Section 9, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Section 8 provides an exemption for hauling invasive species by a licensed garbage hauler. So you can see that when a hauler is transporting from riparian property to a legal disposal site, at least 100 feet away from the surface water ditch or seasonally flooded land, it's allowable for to be hauled off. Section 9 of the bill and Section 10 and Section 11 relate to a pilot project we want to try on Lake Minnetonka that will allow a lake service provider. These are folks, many times they're lawn companies and things like that, or a boat marina. It will allow for a licensed lake service provider to take your boat from your shore and bring it to a storage facility that is not located directly adjacent to the water, and then bring it back. So it establishes a chain of command, allows for this boat to the lake service provider to, the boat won't have to be decontaminated, but it has to be controlled and tracked and be brought right back to Lake Minnetonka. Right now, there are facilities on Lake Minnetonka where you can bring your boat to that are immediately adjacent to the lake or riparian land, and we want to create a new pilot project, see if we can do this in other parts of the state if it works. So there's a lot of moving pieces to it, and we'll come back. There's a report back to the legislature you'll see later on in the bill. Section 12 and Section 13, we're changing some criminal citations to civil citations for different AIS pieces of law. So you can see fails to comply with decontamination, or when you don't complete decontamination equipment. And then 8, fails to comply with invasive species offender training courses, will be able to just issue a civil citation rather than a criminal penalty. So sections 12 and 13 allow for that. Section 14 is a rulemaking piece that at the end of the month we'll be releasing the sonar for the Mississippi River Critical Corridor Area Rule that we've been working on very diligently for probably a year and a half with all the impacted communities from Dayton down to Denmark Township on the Mississippi River. This language will allow us to establish by rule the process whereby these local units of government will have to update their comp plan. It's been discussed with the stakeholders, the cities support it, and also the Met Council supports this language. Section 15 just has us reporting back to the chairs of the natural resources, the committees that have jurisdiction over the DNR, on the success of the pilot project on Lake Minnetonka as well. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Very good. Questions, member? Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we take another stab at the Section 6 and 7? Like, the way I read it, it seems to be removing the exemption for dead plants, but in the quick read-through, might have gotten tripped up in a double negative there. It sounded like you were saying it established an exemption.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct. It removes the exception. So I was incorrect. So.
Further discussion. Any member?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I understand the Lake Minnetonka pilot study. I just question why you would choose that body of water to do that study.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'm Ann Pierce. I'm Section Manager with the Department of Natural Resources for Ecological and Water Resources. This came to our attention through our advisory committee, our AIS advisory committee, and Lake Minnetonka has a number of lake service providers, and some of them have riparian property, but a number of them do not have riparian property. And this is a situation where there's some inequities with that situation, in that the ones without riparian property have to clean their boats even though they're bringing them back right onto the property. And so we looked at Lake Minnetonka. We have a number of staff at Lake Minnetonka, and we have a higher number of local unit of government staff, so inspectors and people who can actually participate in this and make sure that we have the capability of doing that kind of chain of command that Bob was talking about. So that's why we chose Lake Minnetonka. We wanted to see if there was a way where we could address this, and we thought that would be the ideal location because we had both the lake service providers set up there, but also the number of staff we needed to cover it.
Representative Enzo.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Could you define for me what a lake service provider is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. A lake service provider is somebody who would do, for example, store boats over the winter for someone who lives on a lake, uses their boat all summer long, and then they're going to store it off of their property. So they would store boats for them. It could also be somebody who repairs engines on boats. It could also be someone who puts docks and lifts in. Irrigation.
Well, up north we would call that a garage or a marine dealer. Lake service provider? Come on.
Representative Anzell, Mr.
Representative
Anzell, the logic of that reason for that name is they're required to actually take some training because they work in, for instance, the dock. Folks that work in multiple lakes, generally, if they're working in an area
like I'm familiar with where our cabin is, they have two sets of waders, one for zebra mussel or AIS-infested waters and one for not, and they have to use those accordingly. Otherwise, they have to clean them each time when they move from lake to lake. And then the dock people have got training for what how they handle the docks. And the marinas are probably the most common one, but anybody now working in these lakes is required to go through this training, so they're aware of, they have to check to see if a new lake's been infested, things like that. Welcome to the bureaucracy of state government, Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, my good friend, Representative McNamara, you certainly must feel the move toward licensing dock installers and lift installers. That's where this is going, and I'm not sure that I'm ready for that in the North Central region.
Further discussion? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have one concern on this bill on subdivision 4. 6, 7, and 8, would they change the penalties from criminal to civil? My understanding of that is instead of a licensed officer writing the citation, anybody that the DNR allows could be writing that citation, whether it's somebody sitting there just working the landing, or so I have a little concern on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Johnson, we can bring up Colonel Robin Smith to address that issue.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in 84, Chapter 84, under civil penalties, it does say that the civil citations have to be issued by a licensed peace officer, conservation officer. So the inspectors that are not a licensed peace officer or a conservation officer cannot write civil citations.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would just want to make sure that was clarified.
Thank you.
Okay. The bill is going to civil law next, I believe. Further discussion? Anyone in the audience like to speak to the bill? Okay. Representative McNamara moves that House File 2866, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, and the bill has moved on to civil law. Next, we're going to take House File 2845. And the chair will move House File 2845. Mr. Meyer, you want to present the bill, or...
Sure, actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to bring up Colonel Rodman Smith again, and okay. While he's coming up, I do want to take the opportunity to introduce him to the committee. He is our new Director of Enforcement, or Colonel of the Enforcement Division. It was a great honor to actually offer the job to Rodman. You've seen him around the Capitol a lot. He's been doing legislative relations and activities here for many years, and we were just very fortunate to have him as the next colonel. So thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to present the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll run through it and we can let Colonel Smith answer any questions probably.
All right.
Sure, we'll just have Colonel Smith run through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, this bill is broken up into three pieces. And so I'll go through two pieces first, and then the last part of the bill is kind of has a number of sections that are associated with it. So under Section 1, under Prosecuting Authority on Line 1.9 to 1.11, this is really clarifying that county attorneys are the prosecutorial authority, not just for game and fish law, but for all law that is related to natural resources. So, for example, wetlands violations, shoreland violations, aquatic plant management. Some of these laws and some of these cases can get very technical, and for a city attorney or somebody that hasn't do a lot of work around this type of work, It takes a while for us to get them up to speed. We do a lot of work with the County Attorneys Association, getting them up to speed on some of these more non-traditional type of prosecutions that they would normally do. So really what this is doing is saying that the county attorney, we can work with the county attorneys on not just game and fish, but all of our pretty much DNR-related laws. Section 2 is just clarifying that violations of game and fish law, which are 97A, 97B, 97C, are misdemeanors. So in current law, it says that the taking, buying, selling, and transporting, possessing are misdemeanors. The reason we're asking for this change is because last year the legislature passed an initiative that if there's not a specific penalty defined in law, that a violation of any laws defaults to a petty misdemeanor. So really what we're trying to do is just to clarify that a violation of game and fish law is a misdemeanor to make sure that we don't have any slip through the cracks. So that's the first two sections. Section 3, 4, 5 then are related to the gross over limits violations. And this is an initiative that is supported by Governor Dayton. And as a result of a couple of really high-profile cases that our officers have made over the years, there's been some that I guess we could call it shock the conscience of game and fish people that angle and hunt. And the amount of basically theft that some of these individuals do from the people of the state of Minnesota, the penalties are pretty relatively low. And so what we've done here is working with Governor Dayton and others is come up with a felony level provision for certain gross over limits of game and fish. And so what this does is under current law, if you have something over $2,000, it'd be a gross misdemeanor. You have about a 5-year revocation. Okay, and how we'd calculate whether it's a gross misdemeanor or a felony is based on the restitution value of the animals that were taken illegally. So every animal that in the state under Minnesota Rule 6133, which is where our restitution value is, does have a dollar value. So when we look at how we'd prosecute these, it would be based on the total restitution value. So anything over $2,000 is currently a gross misdemeanor. So what this new proposal would do would basically be anything from $1,000 to $2,000 is a gross misdemeanor. Anything over $2,000 could be at that felony level, and then would also increase the revocation to 15 years from any of the game and fish violations. So when you talk about what does $2,000 look like, what does somebody have to do to get a $2,000 restitution value? This isn't going to be simple counting mistakes. This isn't going to be I misread the regulations. If I have a few examples here. So you would have to be 67 walleyes over the limit in order to get to the felony level. So this isn't I had one or too many extra in the bucket. You'd have to... It'd be 40 or more ducks, 5 or more bear or turkey, 2 or more trophy deer, and if they weren't trophy, you'd have to have 4 or more deer. So again, this isn't something where somebody is mistakenly misread a regulation or anything like that. There's a little bit of work that has to go into being this much over the limit. So. And that's, in a nutshell, the gross over limit piece with the felony provision, Mr. Chair, members. I can ask Stan for questions.
Okay. Questions, member? Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My congratulations as well on your new position. Are the county attorneys, their association, okay with this added volume of cases, potentially?
Mr. Chair? Representative, we did have conversations with them, and our attorneys have been talking with their attorneys, and we have not heard anything to the negative on it.
Yeah, when my lawyer gets to talk to your lawyer, oftentimes,
But we have met with them, yes.
Okay.
Additional questions, members? Oh, Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain, under the gross over limits section, paragraph C, I can guess at why this is, but can you just explain the reasoning behind that paragraph C?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Russo, yes, I apologize, I did not cover that. So one of the things we're worried about when we start talking about felony level convictions, and the felony is very serious, and we understand that. And what letter C is every animal has a restitution value, even endangered species. And those endangered species restitution values are usually over $2,000. So if somebody did make a mistake and they took a endangered species, one species could lend them to being possibly charged with a felony. So what this language says is there really needs to be intent on those endangered species. So one's a mistake, but if you have two or more, you're probably, if you're shooting more than two lynx, or if you're, you know, taking two or more endangered species, there's probably some culpability there.
Representative Russo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I thought. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I understand that, I'm sorry, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This relates to Representative Anzell's question. Has there been a fiscal study done on the county's costs for county attorneys who are prosecuting these cases?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not asked for that. They do get some of the monies back in fines. So when a prosecutorial authority does charge somebody and there is some fine levied, some of that money does go back to the County Attorney's Association or to the county attorney individually. You know, this really came to light over our records management system when we started electronically filing our citations. Many of these county attorneys were already prosecuting many of these other things. And so when we got involved with the Minnesota courts, this language came to light, and that's why we've had this conversation. But most of the county, we don't have that many of these cases that go to trial. And so it'd be fairly negligible. They didn't seem to be too concerned about it when we talked to them.
Anything further?
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? I understand that we were going to have a possible amendment to change this from a felony to gross misdemeanor. Was that kind of the intent?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay.
Recognizing the seriousness of the felony, and actually this language passed the Senate Judiciary Committee last year, where the Game of Fish Bill got hung up in the other body on some timing issues and things like that. The Senate Judiciary Committee did remove the felony language, so recognize that we're going to need to go back there anyway.
Okay.
We thought we'd get it in the form that it came out of there with it, if the committee so desired.
Well, and I'm going to be offering an amendment, and I think we can probably pass that out now. It's going to be a DE1 amendment, and I will move the DE1 amendment. We'll be passing it out, and it will include removing the felony and changing it to a gross misdemeanor. But so I think we'll take some other testimony as well and talk to some other folks that would like to work on changing the bill and brought some of their concerns to me. So if Gary Lestico would like to come up and help me explain the amendment. Folks, I had some concerns about some unintended consequences of this language, and we're going to talk about that now. I don't think there's anyone that doesn't want to get to at these folks that are committing some of these crimes, and it's not good to be taking I can't remember how many deer that was that one guy recently, maybe
16.
Yeah, it was ridiculous amount of deer, that trophy deer that this guy had. So I think that's what brought this forward, and we do need to address that issue. So Mr. Lesko, if you would like to explain our amendment. I have moved the DE1 amendment, and if you want to go through it and explain what we've got here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gary Lestico. I'm an attorney. I represent the trapping groups in the state. And this is a bill that I reviewed, and we did have some concerns. I think there are unintended consequences, and it goes to the amendment. I would make a note as to subdivision 3 as far as the prosecution of the prosecuting authority on that, which we would not have any specific concern with that, other than, as Colonel Smith had indicated, that this would just clarify that the prosecuting authority is the county attorney's office. In practical effect, that is the reality in the state. I would note that it says county attorneys must prosecute. And if the intent is that if a game warden brings a citation to the county attorney is bound to prosecute whether they feel that there's adequate probable cause or not. There's probably constitutional separation of powers issues. There would be limitations as to the attorney ethically prosecuting a case if they didn't agree there's probable cause. So if the intent is something more than just that the county attorneys in the state prosecute it, I think that would be a concern for the county attorneys, probably for anyone that's been charged with a fish and game violation. And this goes well beyond fish and game. 97.8.205 clause 5 pretty much covers the entire gamut of any authority that a game warden would have. And so I think it would be a great concern if the intent would be that a prosecutor would be bound to prosecute regardless of whether they felt so or not. I don't even think they could work out plea bargains at that point. My understanding is that's not the purpose. That must should probably be that it's just to clarify that prosecuting authorities for these offenses are the county attorneys. As to the amendment itself, this goes to Section 3, 4, and 5. And I understand, and Trappers specifically, I specifically have no and support that true violators of the game and fish laws be seriously prosecuted. A felony is a very serious matter, that there would be amendment to take that out. But even in addition, this language changes a number of things, I think, that are unintended consequences based on trying to simply prosecute more thoroughly or more vigor just the true serious violators. And one of the thing that the bill would do as it was introduced, 2845 Section 3, is it takes and changes the subject matter for which these more serious penalties from over the legal limit in a closed season or without a valid license to violations of the game and fish laws. So I do have a handout for the committee if the committee would like to review that, and that change is extremely significant based on other statutes, so specifically Minnesota Statute 97A.221, which sets out certain seizure of powers for the DNR in certain cases where there's been contraband between, so if you have an example, it's 5 deer. So 4 of the deer were legally taken. If there's a deer that's illegally taken that is commingled, so it's just set aside the legally taken deer, all 5 of those deer under 97A.221 are then contraband. And the restitution provision, which is set out in Minnesota Rule 6133, counts the restitution value of all contraband. So it would take 1 deer and turn it into 5 deers for restitution value. Minnesota Court of Appeals have issued opinions that that's then all a violation of the game and fish laws. So the bill as drafted, as it was introduced, would essentially take, if 10 people are all fishing and there's 1 fish that's a violation, for restitution value it would cause all the fish to be contraband. Under 97A.221 would cause all the fish to be a violation of the game and fish laws. And suddenly you take 1 sunfish and you turn it into a felony level offense, and it just follows through. I have a handout that sets this out. It follows through as allowed under this statute as it was introduced. I don't think that's the intent. My understanding in the example, I did testify at the Judiciary Committee in the Senate last year. My understanding that they did not pass any of this out of the committee last year because of these concerns. It's not just the felony. It's that it takes these numbers of small violations, compounds them when you have a number of other animals, specifically for trappers, because trappers don't have a possession limit per se. They could keep freezers full of beaver for a number of seasons to wait for the fur prices to increase, all of them legal. But then they have an otter that isn't tagged properly, And the Minnesota Supreme Court and Court of Appeals has held fish and game laws are strict liability. So even if the trapper didn't mean to mistag the otter, just the fact that it's mistagged makes it a violation of the law. It's commingled with the legal fur in these areas. They're suddenly all counted as restitution value. You're suddenly all left with a felony level for a misapplying a tag to a single otter. And it could be in any type of fishing game, because now instead of over the limit or illegal take, as the language had been, it changes it to just a violation of the fishing game. So that what the amendment does is the amendment allows that if the concern is really these trophy animals, and Minnesota's rule 6133 defines trophy animal, it's one of five different kind of animals: typical whitetail, non-typical whitetail, elk, moose, antelope, and bear. So it's an additional, and it sets out criteria on what is a trophy animal, and that the amendment would allow that if a person has two or more trophy animals and they are taken over the legal limit, so they have they take one of these over the legal limit or in a close season or without a valid license, so they meant to do it then, that would then result in that being a gross misdemeanor based on that alone. So it would be just the possession of two or more over the legal limit, and that as to those animals that are taken, that there would be a separate provision in the amendment that would cause for those people that take two or more trophy animals to lose their license to take game, not just trophy animals or not just big game, but any animal in the state, they would lose their license for 10 years. So that would assure that there's no unintended consequences of this commingling as allowed by current law and as the courts have approved. It would just go to those people that specifically target these trophy animals. They take two or more. They'd be subject to gross misdemeanor violations, which is a year in jail, $3,000 fine, and they would lose their license then upon conviction for 10 years. So that's the purpose of the amendment. It just takes out a number of consequences that there's no other way to remove from the bill as it's originally drafted.
Thank you. Questions, members?
Thank you. And you listed some examples of the collateral consequences of the unintended consequence, and I was just thinking about, you know, we allow party hunting for large game animals, and would that protect the inadvertent happening? Should, for example, 10 hunters are in the field at one time and suddenly the party is filled out, or somebody had actually ended up that you have an extra one that you didn't intend to have happen?
So as originally, thank you, Representative, as originally drafted, that would be one of the consequences that could happen. You could have 10 people hunting, they're on a deer drive, they have three deer left, they inadvertently shoot the fourth deer. They bring them back to the cabin, suddenly they're all contraband, and they're well over these restitution felony levels. It would not be hard at all to show that there's a conspiracy or they're aiding each other in doing it. You could have 10 people that could be charged with a felony. Now, I would assume many conservation officers would use their discretion not to do that, and many prosecutors would use their discretion not to do that, but that doesn't mean they couldn't do it. And the amendment would keep that from happening, because the change of the amendment doesn't include, as the bill was originally drafted, for a violation of the game and fish laws. It includes that if there's an animal taken over the legal limit in close season or without a valid license, that would be the criteria for it. So it wouldn't include the restitution values that could encapsulate all of those deer into one, and it has to be a trophy animal. So you could still have, I suppose, some unintended consequences if someone, you and I are deer hunting, and we happened to, by chance, shoot three trophy animals in one day. That would be extremely lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, but very unlikely at least. And then at that time, together they would be contraband, but it's only the one that's over the legal limit that's a violation of under the amendment. So we'd still not be subject to the penalties of this gross misdemeanor, because we only have one deer over the limit at that time.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you for that clarification, and I certainly wouldn't want to have, as an
unintended consequence, individuals being charged with a felony for the actions of another without them really knowing what was going on.
Further questions? Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 1, Subdivision 3, clearly explained that what the intent is here, but I am still troubled by the way that reads, because I'm concerned that the average citizen is going to read that first sentence and assume that that basically takes away a prosecuting attorney's discretion to make a determination as to whether he's got probable cause, whether the evidence is satisfactory to go down that route. So I don't know if there's another way to say this. I think you may have verbalized that, jurisdiction for prosecution of violations, I'm just concerned that the way that sentence reads, if you're not a lawyer, it would imply that there's no discretion there. If a conservation officer writes a ticket, that's the end of it. And we know, obviously, it doesn't work that way. But I just wonder if we ought to not figure out a way to say the same thing, but make sure there is no confusion in the general public of what that sentence means.
And that's still part of the same language that was in the original bill. So we can discuss that a little later, maybe. But Representative Cornish, you have a comment to that issue?
Maybe you could talk with these folks, but you can put the something like that, and that wouldn't say they have to. That this would be responsible. They could still, up to you folks.
Colonel Smith, you have a comment on this particular section?
Mr. Chair, to the specific section, what we did is we mirrored language that's already in statute that says prosecutors must prosecute violations of game and fish law. Mm. So this is the same language that's been in statute for a long time. So trust me, there's been many times where they haven't prosecuted things for us.
Oh, yeah.
And rightfully so.
Boilerplate language, I think, is what they call it, right, Janelle? Okay.
Is it a member of the Boilers Union?
Oh, Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for you. In Section 4, on the description of the period of taking licenses away, just want to make sure that this is what you intended. Paragraph A, you have a 10-year prohibition for someone that's taken the two or more trophy animals. Later on, there's still in the original, unaltered by the amendment, it's only 5 years for restitution value of $5,000 or more. I'm just making sure that's your intent there.
Mr. Lustico?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The amendment only changes what had been changed or proposed to be changed in the bill as introduced, 2845. So there would be situations where there could be, and that's existing law, and so what the amendment doesn't change existing law, it just changes the statute or the bill as introduced.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. However, in the original bill, that $5,000 was changed to between $1,000 and $2,000 in that section. So it just seems it seems that it's kind of an inconsistent scope between those two paragraphs at the moment. So
seems like we should change that as well.
Yeah.
Colonel Smith, you had a comment on that?
Mr. Chair, if I could just a couple comments
on the amendment
and to the testimony. I think I'm not an attorney, but I think much of what the testifier talked about was more consistent with joint and several liability, which is in game and fish law, when there are a number of people conspiring together. Commingled, and the way it was presented here today is I guess a little bit of a different interpretation than what the state looks at commingled as, because under what you heard today is just about any time we have one fish over the limit, we'd be charging people with, the other five fish that were illegally taken as well, if it was walleyes, and that's just not the way it's done in practice, and it's not the way that's ever been done. And so I think there's a little bit of a, you know, usually when we talk about commingled products, they're usually, for example, in white-tailed deer, it would be if you had a freezer full of venison that's already been processed and you can't tell if this packet of hamburgers from this deer or that deer, that's where commingled gets into it. And also with fish, you know, it's hard to tell sometimes with fish fillets. So, but what, you know, so when we talk about commingled, I think there's a little bit more discussion that could be done around that. And then as far as the initial intent of this law, I mean, we've had a number of cases where people have taken gross over limits of fish, and this wouldn't address that. We've had people that are hundreds of sunfish over, and this still wouldn't get to those folks. I mean, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to catch hundreds of sunfish over your limit and clean all those darn things. So, you know, when we say that we're really getting to the trophy, I mean, this is a step forward, but I think the original bill as written is really the intent of, I believe, of especially the governor, but of the department as well.
Additional comments? Representative Russo, we're going to look at your issue and we're going to try to figure out what we can do with that. Maybe we can fix that in the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The chair will renew his motion to adopt the DE1 amendment. You know, folks, usually we give authors the discretion to just put their amendments right into the bill to get it in the shape they want right at the beginning, but I wanted to have the DNR give their perspective on their bill so everybody understood exactly where that was, and I wanted everyone to know exactly where the amendment is taking us. So that's why we did it this way instead of just adopting the amendment. So now I move the DE1 amendment for adoption. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now we will, any further discussion to the bill? Anyone in the audience, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Craig Engwall, Executive Director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'll be brief because that amendment addressed the only issue we had with the bill. Our members and my board are very supportive of increased penalties that affect the pocketbook and the privilege of hunting. And we were wrestling a bit with the felony provision, and now with the amendment, that's resolved any questions that we have. So we are in strong support of the bill as amended.
And you have an event going on probably right now?
Probably right now.
You want to speak to that?
Yes, we are having a reception at the Embassy Suites from 4 to 7. We're in conjunction with a couple other organizations, the co-ops, etc. We welcome anybody down there to talk deer issues and habitat issues and anything you'd like to. And we've got food, and it'd be a great place to stop for dinner.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else in the audience like to speak? Any other questions? With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 2845, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Crime Prevention, and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, and the bill is moved on.
Do we want to do the next bill, or we got time?
I don't know what that's all about.
Members, we've got one more bill to do, and we're just going to lay the bill over. We're not going to take any action on the bill. We're just going to hear a presentation. If we can go through a quick presentation of House File 2844, I'll move the bill just to get the bill before us, and then we'll lay the bill over for possible consideration at a later date. Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time, folks, and I think maybe there's some members that want to get to the deer hunters function, so maybe we can be quick. Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Welsh. I am the Section of Wildlife Operations Manager with the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Lou Cornicelli, Wildlife Research Manager with DNR.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. I hate to be the one to stand between people and dinner, so I will go very quickly. I'm here to talk about 2844, give you a quick overview of the six sections in the bill. Section number one pertains to non-resident underage 16 youth attending camp and fishing. This simplifies the process to allow for non-resident youth under age 16 that are attending a camp in Minnesota from out of state and enables them to fish without a license, just like our resident under 16 youth. Currently, a document is required from the commissioner to authorize the camp to enable that youth to fish without a license. This would enable this to be taken care of at the local level by the camp. Section 2, hunting with bows released by mechanical devices. This is largely a technical fix to clarify that persons age 60 and over can use a crossbow as archery equipment without a permit. By adding this exception to 97B.035 in addition to the provision that was previously provided in 97B.037. Section 3, possession of firearms and ammunition restricted in deer zones. Last year, a provision was inserted into 97B.041 that created for a warning for a first violation of the prohibition of possessing a firearm and ammunition in a deer zone from a period 5 days before the season through 2 days after the season. This adds the provision that the warning applies if the individual is shooting at a target. Section 4, feeding bears. This provision prohibits feeding by hand or other physical contact with bears to address public safety concerns with wild bears that are potentially habituated to human contact. Section 5, restriction on certain motorized decoys. Currently, motorized decoys for waterfowl hunting are prohibited during the first 8 days of the waterfowl season. This would remove that restriction, but retains the restriction on WMAs, State Wildlife Management Areas, and designated waters. And finally, Section 6, beaver season. This provides a tool for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to close the south of fur bearer season in the event of an early thaw. This would prevent the take of poor quality fur and protect against incidental take of otters that may have pups. And that thus concludes my comments. And if you have questions at this time, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Questions, members? This will be the basis for the game and fish bill that we're going to have. There's going to be some things that we're going to look at and add to it, and as we go through the process in the next couple of weeks of this committee. So we're going to lay the bill over. If you have any questions right now, we can address those. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody else like to speak to this bill at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in. Okay, with that, I will lay over House File 2844 for possible inclusion or at a later date. Thank you very much, members. Anything else before the committee before we adjourn for the day? Seeing none, meeting adjourned.